This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are hosted by Anton Angelo and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio. Tonight at 7 o'clock, from podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz. Welcome back to the Sustainable Lens. This is the first show for 2012. It's just Sam and Shane and I for you today. We're going to be chatting about various things we've been involved with, and we hope you have had as lovely a summer as we. Hi, Shane. What have you got for us today?
Hi. Well, I've got my number for the week, which is $20 trillion. That's $20 trillion. Now, one of the things that has been puzzling people is why the fossil fuel industry and its lobbyists have been so opposed to the concept of climate change. And it turns around this $20 trillion. And this is what's $20 trillion is the amount of financial write-off that the oil companies and the oil-producing nations are going to have to leave in the ground. They're going to leave $20 trillion worth of oil and coal and gas reserves in the ground. And they're going to have to do that over the next 40 years. And to put that into some sort of perspective, $20 trillion is about 40% of GDP. So what they're
is that
global GDP?
Global GDP.
Mm. And so you can imagine that if you were suddenly to write off that by turning around and saying, we need to reduce our carbon consumption, our carbon emissions, we have to leave this oil in the ground, you would suddenly see the value of oil industries across the world collapse, because a large chunk of the value of those companies is based on the known reserves. So, for instance, Shell would have a known reserves worth about $1 trillion, say, and that contributes to a huge amount of value within the company. But if they say we have to leave 80 or 90% of that in the ground in order to prevent climate change, then the oil price will collapse and the value of that company will collapse. And there are practically every economy in the world has bases its revenue and its value in oil. So you've got pension funds, you have people's savings, you have bank investments in oil companies. So to turn around and say we need to actually leave this in the ground, you suddenly have this massive collapse in value of the oil assets, and that might trigger a global financial crisis. Well, it would trigger a global financial crisis unless it's regulated and controlled. And just give you some sort of concept of what countries like Saudi Arabia and Venezuela would be looking at. I mean, the income for the income that Saudi Arabia gets every year is 75% of its revenue. In Venezuela, it's 50% of its government revenue. And so you can imagine if they suddenly had this revenue taken away from them without anything to replace it. They're in huge financial trouble, and not only financial trouble, but then it can lead to massive social and unrest. And you can imagine, you know, kind of civil unrest, massive breakdown in their societies.
Dogs and cats living together,
exactly,
reigns of frogs.
That's exactly kind of these kind of crazy things would be happening across the world. Reasons why many governments, I think, are kind of trying to not say let's take oil out of the equation, because it will bring on this big financial collapse. But, of course, what they're not doing then is also refusing then to address the transition to a post-carbon economy, mm-hmm. or a low-carbon economy, by investing in massive renewables. And what we need to do is manage that. So there has to be a global response to that.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, so far, you know, we can't get the governments and the oil companies around the world to come to an agreement based on the Kyoto targets. So how are we supposed to get a global reaction to transitioning to a low-carbon economy? And then, of course, you've got people who are, you know, the CEOs of these companies and the people who are working in them are the oil companies and the fossil fuel companies really want to make sure that their investments are safe, and because that's what they do. That's their job.
Well, they're not just their job; they're legally bound
exactly
to do that. Yeah.
Yes. So no matter what their personal views are, they're legally bound, and the system forces them into this position where they have to maximize the profits for the shareholders, even if that maximization of the profits is going to kill off the planet. So something has to happen there. We have to shift the system. And so this is a huge challenge, but you can see why there's massive resistance.
Mm. It's funny, but it all sounds a little counterintuitive to me, because my understanding, and this isn't even economics 101, because this is high school economics. Surely if you put some kind of damper on the amount of carbon one could extract,
mm-hmm.
They would raise the price, and therefore people would be able to make higher profits if they worked on a percentage basis.
Yeah, this is where we get to the other side of the problem. Once your energy goes over the equivalent of $100 or $150 a barrel of oil, the worldwide economy kind of starts crunching to a very, very severe quick halt. And in fact, the global financial crisis was systemically caused by the crazy gambling that the banks and investment companies were doing around the world. But the shock that knocked the house of cards over that they built was, in fact, the high price of oil.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the shock to the system, the bang that knocked the house of cards over. And so that's why the economy collapse started to collapse in the first place, was because oil had reached that magic number, which means your economy starts to crumble.
Is that one of these magic numbers that is a threshold which is a relatively arbitrary one, but one at which markets start to tremble?
It is, but also it's actually a real world effect, because the amount of resources that you have to put in, like money, that you have to put into your units of energy to drive your economy, that's a real world effect. So if you're having to pay more money per unit of energy to drive your economy, suddenly more of your resources are being sucked into the energy portion, which is what drives your economy, and you lose your profits everywhere, and that's suddenly you start getting, you know, the less profits, the less money is flowing in the economy. It's going into one sector and not flowing through the whole economy, and then your economy starts to collapse and stall and go into recession.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Shane.
Okay.
Thank you. We're going to go into our first song of the day. This is one of the things that I have been looking at over the summer. It's a band called My Bubba and Me, and this is called Wild and You.
So wild, baby, happy being mine. I'm so wild about you, honey, makes me without your fault. I'll fall for your loving until I lose my breath. I spend most of my life now dreaming dreams about you. I spend most of my life now dreaming, baby, of you. Now what would I do shine like electricity lights. I'm so wild, baby, happy would be enough. I'm so wild about you, honey, makes me that joyful turn. I'll run far for your loving until I lose my breath and fall into my
lap. Welcome back to the Sustainable Lens on Radio. Most of today, I think, is going to be talking to Sam, because Sam is very proud of his new book. Do you want to tell us about your new book, Sam?
I'll tell you about the new book and not my Thinking of the Week
thing. Well, you can talk about Thinking of the Week, but I have a sneaking suspicion we will get around it. No, it's an astonishing thing, the Sustainable Lens, a visual guide, available on Amazon now.
It is indeed. Funny you should mention that. Did you mention how it's on Amazon?
Amazon.
It's on Amazon.
Amazon.
Yeah,
that's Amazon. Yes. Dot.
And you can buy it. We'd encourage you.
It's great. A book which I'm very excited about, finally getting out. It was something which had an interesting gestation. It started out just as a sort of some crib notes for a designer that I had working for me, and then realised that what that was a lot deeper, and there was a lot more we could be told using that story. I put it up on the web, and that page has had 120, I think, thousand hits on a single page on my blog. So this is something which people are very, very interested in. So I talk about half of the images off that page and use them to tell us the story of sustainability. It works on a few levels. It's telling the story of sustainability through its pictures, and by pictures I'm meaning diagrams. So as it says on one of the early pages in the book, please don't buy this book if what you're expecting is wildlife photography, because there isn't any. It's not about fluffy penguins and pictures of them. It's trying to explore what the concept of sustainability is, and how we can put that into practice.
And when I think about other books that I have seen in the genre, they tend to be thick and wordy and valuable and worthy. Wordy and worthy, I think, are the two things that spring to mind, where this is very visual. It has an enormous number of illustrations and diagrams and lots of white space, which I enjoy.
The book is laid out with the diagrams on the right-hand side, and that's all there is on the right-hand side. And that was a suggestion of a colleague from San Francisco who said we should be celebrating the elegance of these diagrams.
And one of the things that I noted about the book was, when I was going through it, was the development from the first pictures about sustainability, the first images, and how it transitions through through the decades, and how not only do the images kind of reflect our thinking, but they also shape the way we think about sustainability. And one of them was that image, one of the first images that you come across in the book, which is the many people might be familiar with this, which is the sustainable development image as like a Greek temple, where you have sustainable development as a triangular arch at the top, supported by three columns, and the three columns are social, environment, and economy columns. And somehow then this image, and we're not sure where the concept of pillars came
from. That's one of the few images in the book that we couldn't find the original author or artist of. Most of the others we could find us, and I've written off to Barbier and asked him about and asked for permission to use and things. That was one of the ones which it's a bit of a mystery as to where that came from. The Brundtland report didn't use the term pillars. And I see it all the time. People refer to the United Nations pillars. And it kind of like came in through kind of a back door, that people started using it and attributing it to the United Nations. And in fact, more recently, the United Nations has kind of started using pillars to describe the three things. That the report that came out last week, the big one, has the word pillars in it. But early on, certainly pillars wasn't used. And so what those images do is they set up how you're going to think about it. And so those two things, those three pillars, you can imagine a Roman temple being held up by those three pillars, and you can use that metaphor of here is these big solid things holding up the roof of sustainability. But then you can look at that and say, hang on, why? I thought those three things were sustainability. So what are they doing holding this sustainability thing up?
What is sustainability?
It doesn't actually help you. It doesn't actually help you understand what sustainability is.
And that's something that I over the last year have been, as I've been sitting here and listening to people talking about environmentalism and talking about economics and talking about, and I wonder how, and seeing the word sustainability becoming extraordinarily sexy in the public sphere, in the discourse in the public sphere. And I smart using phrases like discourse and public speech. Anyway, but still not really understanding what the hell it means or how people are using it.
No, and you know, the Brundtland report did a big thing in saying these three things together, and only when they're together, are sustainability. And then you think about how you might represent that and tell that story. And there's a few options of how you might pull those pillars together. So there's the actual pillars type model. There is the sort of the ideas that those things are a balance. Usually dropping the social and just considering the environmental and
the economic,
as if they're in opposition. And so sustainability is somehow finding a balance, which you might think, yeah. But that sets them up in opposition. And sustainability is not those things in opposition. So sustainability, by definition, is those things working together and with the addition. And so there's a few, and there's a few variations on that. You can imagine, and there is in the book, several variations on triangles, where if you have those three things and you're having a balance between them, much like if anyone that's done soil science or various other sciences use plotting things on a triangle.
The dismal science, economics, is flush with triads. Yeah.
Yes. Well, what economics brought to the sustainability diagram was Edward Barbier's three-ring circus, the three-ring, you know, most of the Olympic logo Venn diagram. And which is, if you ask most people to draw a picture of sustainability, that's what you get. In fact, I've tried this. You do get, you know, that is how they would represent what sustainability is. And what people forget, and what the diagram does support, but people just don't seem to realize, is that sustainability is only the bit in the middle. And it's not the whole diagram. And because it's not the whole diagram, what that means is you can't just take one of the circles on its own and still carry on calling it sustainability. And so that's why I describe the notions of environmental sustainability or economic sustainability as a nonsense. Sustainability is only that bit in the middle.
But that's complicated and hard. I mean, that's...
Which is why it's a picture book.
No, exactly.
There is words in the book. Each page is hopefully standalone, so there is a progression, a narrative running through the book. But I worked really hard to make sure that each page, with the diagrams on the right-hand side and on the left-hand side, there is a page full of writing, which is at least tangentially about that diagram. It includes an extended caption for the diagram and positioning where it is. So what the book then does is it then goes on and says, well, okay, the problem with this pillars model, these three things, is all of the ways of thinking about it say, well, here is these three things. Together they're sustainability, but we don't really have a way of thinking about how these things integrate. The we either think about them still separately, contributing to sustainability, or we might say, okay, it's the overlap that is sustainable. But that's not actually very helpful. If you just say it's an overlap and you're trying to develop a sustainable program or something, just knowing that those two things overlap, or three things overlap, isn't actually very very useful. So, and the other thing about those pillars is because there's no way real interaction from there's no real way of representing the nature of the relationship. As soon as you dig down on each one of them explodes out into all the other things, and you might, you know, you try applying it to a city, and this is one of the problems with the city-type indicator models, is that all of a sudden you're putting, let's say you put transport over in a in a social part of the diagram, and you think, hang on, what about the environmental decisions that are being made about transport? And then people end up trying to link things to both things or put them in both places. And it just, as soon as you start adding, trying to put it into practice, those pillars just sort of crumble away. There are various attempts to add a fourth pillar, usually culture, which interestingly is possible from a, in a diagrammatic sense. You can actually do it. Think of a Venn diagram with a sort of a clown face superimposed, sad face superimposed on the top of it. That will get you the four-way interaction, but no one's kind of done that.
And people's understanding of culture is probably as good as people's understanding of sustainability, to be perfectly frank, in what culture
is. Adding, you've got these, while you've still got these three or four or even more separate things, and as complex and as elegant as your model gets is, here's these things, now mush them together. Then when you try and actually put it into practice or use it in an explanatory way, it falls to bits.
It's interesting. I wonder, and this is a little tangential, but that's me. I wonder about, we've talked to people who are sustainability managers on the show, and we've also seen the growth of the sustainability industry. I worry whether it becomes a separate thing on its own, divorced from these other things, whether it becomes its own silo of thinking, rather than, I think, what you're trying to get at, which is a synthesis of thinking.
Yeah, well, the book, of course, is called Sustainable Lens, the same as this radio show. There's a reason for that. It's about a way of looking at the world. And the sort of second half of the book takes that idea of, let's say that you had a pair of augmented reality glasses and you could put them on, what would you see? You're standing in the studio or out on the street or at the top of the hill, you put these glasses on, what would you see differently? How would it help you act sustainably? What is it that you'd need to do? And I'll come back to what you might see in a minute. But the key point is that is something that everybody needs to be able to do, no matter what their role or what their profession. So while there might be the occasional expert in sustainability, because it is an area which might get quite complex, or there might be particular questions that need to be answered, it's absolutely something that every engineer needs to be able to view through that lens, or every teacher, or whatever the job is that you're doing, you need to be able to see through that. So I argue against having a sustainability office in organizations, with a bit of a caveat, is that it's probably useful to have one just to keep reminding everybody. So it's sort of like it's a there to prick everybody else to do it, rather than somebody that, you know, we've done all this, we better send it off to the sustainability office to get their tick on it.
A bit like health and safety.
That is a way of viewing.
Yeah.
A way of viewing the viewing the world. So once you've dismissed this kind of like that you look at things in pillars, sustainability you have to start saying, okay, well, what is it then? And there's various ways of looking at that, and the book traverses quite a few different attempts to do that. And we have things like the spaceship, which we've talked about before, which is a really significant development, that thinking that the Earth is a spaceship, you know, with finite resources, is a very strong thing that we can argue.
This is going back to Lovelock and people like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Buckminster Fuller.
Mm.
And so from that we get sort of to systems type thinking. Now the problem with that spaceship model, and again it's represented in diagrams and is in the book, is with that comes the notion that people designed the system, that people understand the system, that the system can work at 100% capacity, that everything in the system is for the purpose of that mankind intended, and so on and so on, and that you know the waste systems are perfect and so on. So people are kind of a bit, just a little bit worried about the use of that metaphor. While it's great for getting across that infinite resources or finite resources argument, then the notion, and it's really good, the other good thing you can take from that argument is the notion that we're all crew.
Mm.
There's no passengers on the spaceship. And that's a really hard-hitting thing to say. But then if we start to use it too much, we get this idea that we can design this system, that we understand what's going on, we can understand what's going on, whereas an awful lot of things we can't understand.
That's approached in some disciplines under the banner of functionalism, isn't it? That everything has a function and that it can be determined, that there's environmental and ecological functions for both environmental and cultural, and we got past that. We got past that because we realised that it just isn't a rich enough metaphor to actually explain what's going on.
Well, also coming from that same sort of space, although from with quite different implications, is the Gaia.
Mm.
The Earth is an organism, not like an organism, is an organism. Mm. And that those systems operate in balance and so on. And that has also had a significant impact. And while the teleological sort of implications of that, i.e. that things happened for a reason, you know, this plant is growing so that it can do this, it's thinking, that sort of stuff, is most people have now gotten past that, including Lovelock himself in 1988. I think when he republished it and Daisy World, it was more of a simulation. Look, this is what will happen. It will control itself.
Mm.
That notion of the entire system, the Earth as an entire system, we are part of that system, not some sort of super gods on that system, is very strong.
One of the pictures that I found really illuminating and captured me was the idea of the coal-fired computer, where you have your computer there and you're powering it using the coal that's actually burnt away in our coal-fired power stations. And I found it suddenly like a really, really powerful image, because it suddenly brought you the reality of what it takes to drive that computer. Do you want to speak a little bit about that, or the concept
of course, It's reasonably easy to calculate the coal equivalent energy that a computer is using, and it's easy-ish to calculate the energy how many energy units this thing is using per minute, and so it would be reasonably easy to say, okay, if this was actual coal burning on my desk, how much smoke would it produce? And so this is looking at making the invisible visible.
Mm.
So this is the impact that this thing in front of me is happening. Because we assume we've gotten very comfortable with this appliance sitting on our desk. And we're totally disconnected from the fact that it's got in its production, in its use and in its eventual disposal, because we need to build that into the minute-by-minute time we're using it, impacts. But it's like, well, I'm just typing away. It's this nice, shiny thing. And so if we could see that smoke, we can start to ask ourselves, how would we manage it differently? What would be the implication of having a purple haze coming out of my computer as I'm trying to use it? Now, if it was real smoke, kind of perversely, we would solve it another way. We'd put a chimney on and, you know, make it go away. But it's still not made the actual thing go away. We still need to do it. So it might prompt us to do things that could lessen the impact for us of that smoke. And the obvious thing would be to try and increase its lifespan. And if the smoke was coming out while we were using it, that included the time that was left on at night when we're not using it, if that was like brought back in, we would quickly realize that, hey, turning it off at night does make a difference. And so we could and it might prompt us to do those sorts of things. Now, there's two reasons why that story is there. Firstly, that in terms of what's the sustainable lens seeing, making those sorts of things visible is the first thing we have to do. We do need to be able to have some idea. If we had these glasses, we would like to know when we look at the light switch, oh, hang on, there's not much water in the dams at the moment. Maybe I don't need the light on after all. That kind of feedback would be useful, being able to see where things come from, where the power's, where it comes from. Second reason it's in the book is that that's only a start. While that is reducing things down to energy equivalent of the production, the use, and the disposal, it is only the energy equivalent. And if you look at the work which I've talked about before by Leo Benani on the source open supply chain mapping. Mm-hmm. So he's out of the Media Lab at MIT. And so what he has worked very hard on is making the supply chains of things visible and representing those supply chains. And so if you take, as we've discussed before, if you take the components that go into a computer, and I've forgotten what it is, 48, I think, components that go into a computer that are assembled in Shanghai or wherever and where they all come from, they include cobalt from the Congo and copper from Chile. I just made that up. I think that's where it is.
Sounds right.
And something you've never heard of from a country you've never heard of. In fact, there's probably 30 of those. And I've challenged my students on several occasions to find me one of those sources that somebody somewhere is not describing as unsustainable. And you don't have to work very hard to figure out that they're fighting a war in the Congo, and it's mostly over the cobalt, or is the cobalt survived, and I've forgotten what it is. You'll know, Anton, I suspect. Several million people have died over that stuff. The copper mostly in the world mostly comes from one mine in, I said it was Chile, and it's got a long time, and they had to move the town of several hundred thousand people to away from the copper mine because they were all getting sick and stuff. So, you know, this is people that are, not to put too fine a point on it, dying to produce my laptop. That only at the start of this conversation, I was quite proud of my nice shiny laptop sitting on my desk. Mm. So while we can make those sort of like energy equivalent visualizations, we can have, you know, represent a coal-powered computer. That's a feasible thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's only so much just scraping the surface. That's only.
Well, also, you're talking about, if we're wearing these lenses, we're doing it voluntarily. We're only keeping the honest honest. How do we extend that and raise consciousness?
Because what we don't need to be doing is just treating the sustainability, as we've said before, several times before, is not a... We need to be treating sustainability beyond the negative.
Mm.
Sustainability is not just about what's going wrong or what's bad. I would argue that is a very small percentage of what is sustainability. In the book, I've got one page of gloom, and I called it that after the publisher insisted that I had something in it, sort of saying, you know, you need to be saying what's going wrong. And I was not happy about doing that. But eventually called it One Page of Gloom, and then sort of like, can we move on now? And it is interesting to see how those, you know, how those things are represented. So, but what's more important is that these glasses or this way of viewing the world is beyond this sort of exercise in despair. It is about hope. It is about promoting ways forward. It is about suggesting things. So, yes, if we could have those glasses that showed the complete devastation that our computer was causing, it's just going to make us miserable. And it's not actually giving us anything to actually help us do anything better. So while I was describing that, I don't think that would be a good idea at all. It doesn't actually help us do things. But if it could help us, if those glasses could see different dimensions that could help us act in a more sustainable way, then I think it would be something that would be useful and people would want to wear. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting that this is a blueprint for how, you know, actually building these glasses. Although I have published it in that form kind of as a joke. Because the US military is spending, I think it's $2 billion on an equivalent pair of glasses for foot soldiers. And we can easily specify, well, they can, what would those glasses do? They want to be able to see behind walls, and they want to be able to look out across a crowd and have everybody color-coded and point to the baddie and all those sorts of things. If they were to turn up and say, right, here's your $2 billion, we're going to make these sustainability lenses, I don't think we'd know where to start. We're not in a position, until my book, of course, we're not in a position to actually say, well, these are the things that we would like to be able to see. Now, they are not going to come up with the $2 billion and say, we've decided not to build, forgotten what it's called, the military one.
This heads-up display thingy.
Yeah. What we're going to do is going to give it to your greenies and you can spend it instead on your green growth. but what we need to move to is this being a way of thinking. We need to move to this is how everybody sees all the time. Now, that's going to change according to what they're doing. It's going to change according to what it is that they're looking at or their state of mind. And it's not going to be something that sort of gets in the way and paralyzes them. But we need that sustainable looking, sustainable seeing system through a sustainable lens to be the norm for everybody. So what are those sort of parameters that people need to be able, that we need to be able to deal with. So this is still continuing this sort of discussion of what sustainability is. Mm-hmm. So the book starts with, you know, a historical discussion of sustainability. Where did it come from? Where did it come from? And it's, you know, partly in its roots in the foresters of the Enlightenment. It comes partly from the anti-slavery campaign. It comes partly from the social work against sort of industrial revolution factories. All of those sorts of things came together, and through the 70s and 80s got mushed together into what we now describe as sustainability. That history was partly there to give it a context, but partly to rally against any notion that sustainability is something which is, you know, last year's idea. Or, you know, I read so many times people saying things like, you know, sustainability is a term has been around since 2004. What?
Yeah.
What they mean is that that's when they first noticed it.
Or someone who's smart enough to have found Google Trends has typed it in. Yeah.
So what are the things that we need to be doing? How do we need to see? Now, one of the things, again, we've talked about on the show before is the notions of uncertainty. We've talked about the book, The Virtues of Ignorance. Mm-hmm. I said I didn't like the title, but, you know, I think it would be better if it was Virtues of Humility. How would we manage if we worked on the basis that we're probably wrong? Now, that doesn't mean we don't do anything, but it means that we need to be thinking about, hang on, what's the backup plan here? If before we go and go drilling in the Southern Basin, what's going to be our plan when we discover that our technology for not having it legal all over the place wasn't as good as we thought it was? Well, we don't have one. Well, maybe it's not a good idea then. It's that kind of way of looking at those sorts of things. So how do we represent that uncertainty? How do we think about that uncertainty? How do we see that uncertainty? Uncertainty in sort of maps and diagrams is usually represented with things like error bars, or you might be a, instead of a precise location for something, you might have, well, it's around here somewhere.
Mm.
It's not so much talking about that sort of positional uncertainty, but recognizing that there's an awful lot that we don't know and can never know. And so how can we make those sorts of decisions? Another dimension, so uncertainty is one of the dimensions that we want to be trying to add to our vision. Another one is looking at things over at much, much greater scales, in particular spatial and temporal. So if we're making a decision about something, how is that going to influence somebody in, you know, little old lady in China, to one thing? Or how is this going to influence somebody who's several generations not yet born?
Mm.
This interesting work done on time, on representation of time, that we do that. There's the interesting discussions that the city council has come back to on a complete misunderstanding of what intergenerational equity means. Intergenerational equity is one of the basis of sustainability, and with the exception of one councillor, and presumably others are around the side, but there's one councillor being reported.
Ever on the show soon, hopefully.
The rest of them, at least the ones that have been reported, have got it totally wrong.
Mm.
I did a review of 40 books that mentioned intergenerational equity, and one of them, and it wasn't a particularly scholarly book, used intergenerational equity to mean make people pay for stuff later. Everybody else, it's about not reducing the choices of future generations.
Hmm.
So if we have that kind of basis, and if we have that, and it's a very difficult thing to do, we don't have a way, you know, our courts, our legal processes don't have a way of representing future generations in the decisions that we're making.
Hmm.
They don't exist.
Just
the only way that they do exist is in the temporal thing. Like, in, you know, we can say, well, they're kind of like, we don't want to damage the environment because that's what they're going to inherit. But, you know, people say, oh, who cares? And move on.
Just as a note, we're speaking from Dunedin. If anyone's wondering when we talk about the City Council and is listening to us on a podcast, we're getting quite a few listeners on our podcast from all around the world, and getting some quite good responses from it, from www.sustainablelens.org. Plug. So, yes, I just thought I'd bring that in. No, time is a fascinating thing, because this is one of the things that the lens... You keep using the word dimension and dimensions, and I'm glad we've got round to the idea of time, because, and the uncertainty of knowing what's going to happen in the future. But there are things we do know that are happening, and even those things are... for political, for practical, pragmatic reasons in the minds of the people doing it, are denied. And I'm thinking about things like, and I'm sorry to sort of bring up gloom again, but about things like global warming. Even the things that we have a feeling that we know are true are... discussed or are
externalized.
Yeah. Where I'm wondering how the lenses will deal with time at that kind of level as well.
Yes, well, the whole premise really is that we need to stop externalizing those sorts of things.
Mm.
And it's about what are the diagrammatic ways that people are already using to try and pull those sorts of things together. One of the areas that it looks at is the how do we put these things into practice. Now, the book's not about here is a picture of a solar panel, or here is a you know, energy efficient house. It's clearly not those kinds of ideas. It is about what does sustainability mean, which people can then take and that say, okay, I can apply those notions to doing these sorts of things. So
there isn't any compost recipes in here.
There is no compost recipes, and there is no pictures of polar bears,
chickens.
No, we do have just gotten 4 chickens, though.
Okay.
But it does look at how these ideas can get taken up by professions. So how might, you know, what would be a sustainability view of accounting? How might we take the sort of the singular dimension of traditional accounting and add sustainability to it? How is that represented? The Forum for Future has got a cube that gets bigger to represent that. How are we representing changes to sustainability in diagrams? So the maturity models and things of sustainability. Although interestingly, earlier on in the book, in the bit where it's looking for different alternatives, that there is a discussion on the journey. Lots of people just describe sustainability as a journey, and there's lots of representations of that. And there's a research team, in fact, a New Zealand research team, whose name escapes me, Kate from AUT and Marcus Milne, used to be from Dunedin, are quite dismissive of the term journey in financial accounts, because it's being used as an excuse for not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, we're off on this journey, we're setting off on this great thing, we're doing the sustainability thing, when in fact they've taken one teensy little step and not really addressing the fact that the whole business is unsustainable.
And also it's just a total and utter cliche.
Yeah, but at least if you say it that people know what you're talking about, I think it's...
I mean, cliches are often true. That's certainly, but at the moment, it's one of those. It's being used as one of those business speak, and politico speak as well. Mm. But and I think your characterization of it as being an excuse for not doing anything is exactly right.
Although the good thing about describing something as a journey is that this is a journey that we're on, and we might never get there. We're never going to get to a point of perfect sustainability. Mm. The Interface Carpets book, one of them, mid-course correction. You know, you don't have to have all the answers, and before you can start moving in this direction, mm-hmm. it's okay to move around and do that. And things like the natural step funnel, which is representing. The choices that people are made have some corrections. You don't need to get it all perfect the first go. Just, you know, a step in this direction is very much worthwhile. I'm very dismissive of anybody that says, I am sustainable, or this organization saying we're a sustainable organization. You're working in that direction, and that's absolutely to be encouraged.
Mm.
But describing, you know, anyone being perfect in that environment is wrong, particularly if you dig a bit deeper and it finds out that they're still flying people around the world, but they're using carbon offsets. You know, how about not flying everybody around the world rather than just trying to cover up the mess you're making?
And there's a certain amount of Ozymandian thinking, as it were, in that as well, thinking that, you know, here we are, but in 100 years' time, what will history make of that? And we know that in 100 years' time, things are going to be very different. Exactly how, we don't know. But we know that people are going to be looking back at the efforts that people are making at the moment and finding them either foresighted or lacking. And it's actually not a matter of chance necessarily which one is true, but because we have an idea, well, we have an opinion. Again, I start going down that sentence and realizing, no, we don't know which ways are going to work the best for us. I mean, we were just talking before about a genetic lab who are growing yeast to brew diesel, mm-hmm. Straight from organic matter, and going into production at the moment. Now, this is new stuff. We don't know whether that's going to the effect that could have on the 30 trillion. Dollars that you were talking about.
Yeah, $20 trillion.
$20 trillion would be enormous. Mm-hmm. It would have a huge effect on exactly that.
Hmm. But as part of that, you hope that people are sitting down and sketching out in a diagram, if you will, as a system, all of the things that are going on in there, and trying to come to terms with what's likely to be happening, and what's likely to be happening over the different time scales, different spatial scales, what's likely to be happening under these different uncertainties. Ray Anderson from Interface did some really, really nice work on representing the company, their carpet company as it was in the mid-90s, as a system. And this is what it should be like as a sustainable system, and what are the steps that we need to do to get there, recognizing that some of those steps might sort of seem a bit circular, or we did this and it didn't work, so we'll do this instead. So long as you work on the basis that what happens if we're wrong here. So you don't want to be doing anything like having your enzyme eating or producing enzyme that produces diesel or whatever else you're talking about, if the consequence of that renders the whole Midwest of the states unsuitable for anything else, because that would be a catastrophic thing to do. You need to be aware of those sorts of things. One of the things that I think that sustainability is interesting, it needs to be business as usual, but people need to recognize that it's a new business as usual. It's a significant transformation. And what people tend to do is come up with things that are, wholly away from the things that are currently working. And in terms of diagrams, a diagram in the book that I really like is one from, actually I can't remember where it's from, but it's a diagram which takes the construction diagram, the time, quality, and cost diagram, and you would have seen it on lots, and in fact it sort of goes around.
I've drawn it 100 times in project management training.
It goes around the sort of email. People think that it's really funny, and they've just invented the notion of pick any two. You can't have all three. It goes around all the time. We're computer geeks, you understand, folks. And so, what? Shane, you've got in front of you. What does it say? Who made it? It does say who made it somewhere. Augenbro and Pierce. And so they're using this to support the construction industry. And so what they've gone is they've expanded that diagram to include, it's got that in the middle, they described that as the old paradigm, and they've expanded it to include at the corners human satisfaction, negative environmental impact, and minimal consumption of matter. And so while that might still have some of that balance type notions that I dismissed at the start, I would be, in fact, I have, thrilled to bits to present that to some construction workers, or in my case, construction academics. Here is something that they recognize. This is something that they understand. This is how projects are managed. We can understand that it's about finding the sweet spot in here where we can get these things. And what they're doing is saying, okay, that expands out. Sustainability is thinking bigger. Let's expand that out to something, and it's a model that they will represent. It's a significant change, because what it actually does is it turns what they've been doing upside down, but it's on the top of something that they'll recognize. And I think that's a really important thing that we need to not lose sight of when you're working with people or helping things. Is the model that people are using already is a useful place to start. Now, one of the areas that I think is important is working with people, and that the notions of the participation. And I think that when you said, is it only going to be the sustainability freaks that are using this? That would be a real shame. Because what we need to be doing is empowering everybody to think like this, everybody to be able to see with this sustainable lens. So how is seeing like this going to aid participation? How is seeing like this going to aid communication? Because we don't know what we're doing, and because there are no right answers for everything, the ways that people can see, the ways that the structures that people use to aid their seeing, aid their perception, we need all of them. And so, what are the models that people currently use to do that? How is there a Buddhist way of seeing sustainably? Is there a indigenous way of seeing sustainably? And there are representations of those sorts of things for how things these work. They tend to be things that value values. They tend to be things that value families. They tend to be a lot. They to completely break down any notions that Europeans might have of separations between environment and people.
Mm-hmm.
So if you start saying, okay, those two things don't exist, you know, there's no separation between those, then it starts to be quite a different thing that we are dealing with. And we can't predict with 100% certainty what it is that is going to, what climate change is going to impact climate change is going to have. So any different ways of looking at things, it's worthwhile, and it's worthwhile valuing those, and it's worthwhile integrating those ways of seeing into our ways of seeing.
I suppose one of the words we haven't used, and it's kind of odd that we haven't, considering the metaphor that we're discussing, is the word vision. Terms of vision is in terms of actually having an idea of where it is you want to be when you get there. Have you got any ideas about a vision for that, personally?
Yes and no.
Considering we have 3 minutes.
Yes, I don't want to impose my vision of what it is. So I don't want to say this is what I think you should see when you're viewing sustainably. What I want to say is that I think that you need to be aware of that. You know, it would be good if you could find ways of making sure that when you're looking at something, you're looking at very much longer term than you might otherwise do, and very much wider scales than you might always do, and making sure that you are aware of things that are culturally at different scales to what you're thinking. In terms of species. I tried to make a word out of that, didn't work. In terms of species that you're looking at, much wider than you might normally do. So I might say, yes, the vision needs to include those things, but I wouldn't want to say that my vision is necessarily one of windmills and this and that and the other thing that you should be doing. What I think, and one of the diagrams towards the end of the book, it sort of presents, you know, here is a landscape. And there's a whole different ways of looking at those landscapes. There's no one sustainable way at looking at this landscape. Landscape meaning the whole human ecosystem. You wouldn't want to try and separate out and say this is the best sustainable way of looking at it. There's a whole lot of different ways. And if you're looking at sort of using uncertainty and values and participation, all those sorts of things, everybody's way of looking at it sustainably is equally valid. You'll be pleased to know that Flux got into the book.
Oh, okay, excellent.
Sort of late on in the work, I wasn't happy with it. It's kind of finished on a bit of a downbeat, and so the discussion that we had on the radio, in fact, we used to say that, you know, it's about not taking yourself too seriously. Yeah. It's about participation. It's about looking for that bigger. The bigger rules, not focusing on the little ones.
Well, we just have to wind up now. Thank you very much, Sam, for introducing your book to us. It's available at all good booksellers online, and hopefully at the local university bookshop as well. Do you think they've got a copy of
it? I don't think the publishers talk to them, but I should make sure that happens.
Absolutely. And I have a chat with them. They might even do a launch for you.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, it's a very good idea. I'm in for a party. And thank you very much, Shane, for joining us today. My name's Anton Angelo. You've been listening to Sustainable Lens on Radio.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.